want to talk about it, you can call, get in touch with me at Paul R. Kaboo, PaulRKBOO at gmail.com. I got to get out of here. The Invisible Committee, now, hot off the presses. Check it out on the internet, how the paradoxes within paradoxes within paradoxes, us depending on internet, when we should be out there doing whatever we need to do to break the spell. All right, I'm out of here. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 25th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park in Portland. The Good in the Hood Music and Food Festival is the largest multicultural festival in the Pacific Northwest. This three-day music festival opens up with a community parade that travels through Northeast Portland and ends at Lil's Albina Park. The parade starts at 11 a.m. from King Elementary School on Saturday, June 24th, and ends at Lil's Albina Park, where there will be music, food, and resources while connecting people with experiences that strengthen unity in community. Again, that's the 25th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park at North Flint Street and Russell Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Immigrants and Refugees Conversation on Wednesday, June 21st at 6:30 p.m. at the Hillsdale Community Church in Portland. The Immigrants and Refugees Conversation is part of an educational series on the core causes of forced migration, problems of refugees and immigrants, and the ways that we can be of assistance. Again, that's the Immigrants and Refugees Conversation on Wednesday, June 21st at 6:30 p.m. at the Hillsdale Community Church, 6948 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's just about 9:01, and first up this morning, we have Political Perspectives, today presenting Project Censored Radio. It's an interview with Catherine Olmsted about conspiracy culture in the media. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, but before that, we've got Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary, and at 11 o'clock, The Food Show, all about food and how to grow it and eat it and all kind of stuff that Chris will let us know about at 11 o'clock. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thanks in advance for taking care of that. And here we go with Political Perspectives. Thanks for listening to KBOO this morning.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon. On today's program, we'll take a critical look at conspiracy culture in media. We'll be joined by Dr. Catherine Olmsted of University of California at Davis. Please stay with us. Because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. When that commodities or constant turn to global economy. I mean, we're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty knowledge. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. And later we'll be joined by our special announcer, Amy Casey. As you're all aware, Desiree McSwain, listeners, is not here today, but don't worry, she will be returning. As she talked about a couple weeks ago, with her pregnancy, she's going to be in and out of the studio. But don't worry, she will be returning. She's creating a life, and it's tough to create a life and criticize corporate media at the same time.
Amen.
We love Desiree, and she'll be back. I think it's always important to say what's going on in our lives, humanize the hosts here. So we're broadcasting again from California State University East Bay in lovely California. As
part of that, we're continuing to pump out more and more content. I want to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/show. There you can access content that's not available anywhere else, original Project Censored content, because we just do not have enough to put on the radio. Amy, why don't you tell us who is going to be on the show today?
Hello, listeners. I am Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest will be Dr. Catherine Olmsted. She is a professor in the Department of History at University of California, Davis. Today, we will be discussing conspiracy culture with Dr. Olmsted, and later on in the program, the gang will examine the continuing conservative shift in corporate media. But before we begin, a few reminders for our listeners. Please send us feedback. We really, really want to hear from you. We want to know your thoughts, your questions, comments, concerns. You can send that feedback to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. And in order to keep the show on the air, we need you to show your support, show some love. But you can do that by going to projectcensored.org/show to learn how you can support the Project Censored Show.
All right, thank you very much, Amy. So as Amy reminds us, today's topic is conspiracy culture, which is, it's, you know, ironically, I've watched it over the last like 20 years grow and have a larger and larger influence on what used to be called mainstream. And I'm starting to think now that, what passes for mainstream is actually conspiracy culture. I'm thinking of things like, of course, like climate change deniers, right? These folks who think that there's this global conspiracy to falsify studies to, I guess, for some left-wing business. I don't even know. Something like that. Something about this culture of conspiracy. But what's interesting, you start to see somewhat of a backlash recently about this. I saw that Alex Jones, who's known as kind of the wheelhouse, if there's any potential conspiracy, he'll put it on the air as fact. And he actually had to apologize for his lies about the Chobani company, in which he had leaked connected to this sexual assault case, and et cetera. And he actually had to apologize, and he falsified this conspiracy on the air. And I'm wondering if this will open up a trend where more of these people will be held accountable for the lies they disseminate. The reason why I thought this was important, why I'm really excited to have Dr. Olmsted on, I would say that we have the first president elected who's actually a product of conspiracy culture. We saw it in like the Ron Paul campaign and some of this coming up. And that's not to say everything about Ron Paul is a conspiracy, so don't send me your hate mail. I think Trump is sort of the first like really product of this conspiracy culture. I mean, what do you think about that, Nick?
Well, I think there's a really deep history, American culture, of distrusting certain segments of the population. For example, you know, let's go back to climate change deniers. I think culturally, we've all, in different segments and for different reasons, been sort of culturated to mistrust scientists. So, you know, I could talk, for example, about African Americans who have a particular mistrust of scientists. Many people forget that certain elements of the African American culture, of African American culture, passionately distrust Planned Parenthood because Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist. And you think about things like the Tuskegee experiments or any of the other medical disasters that have been perpetuated on the bodies of African Americans. So that's real stuff. But there's also stuff that I think that we perpetuated since the really, I'm thinking about film, since the beginning of film, the evil scientist, right? The notion of the guy who doesn't consider the ethical portion of his experiments and the experiments overrun, sort of the Dr. Frankenstein thing. And I think that that sets people up who are scientists for this kind of conspiracy piece. So it doesn't matter, I think, that people say, well, 98% of all scientists who are involved in climate concur that man-made climate change is real. There's a culture that's always been there of mistrusting scientists. And I wonder, you know, like, whose fault that really is? Is that the fault of scientists for being sort of hidden away within ivory towers and labs and not engaging with the public enough? You know, because if somebody asked you, okay, well, right now, who are the public intellectuals amongst scientists? You've got who? Bill Nye? Right?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
And Neil deGrasse Tyson. And who else do we have? That speaks volumes, I think. And there's not enough of them who are out in the public that we can trust. We can sort of personalize who they are. So they're easily demonized.
Yeah, I think you've hit on an important component there about the actual people in the scientific community not reaching out to the public, because what you have, I think, that fills that vacuum is you have these like snake oil salesmen who come up and they try and fill that vacuum, right? Like Sean Hannity or Alex Jones, and they tell you these really simple narratives you can wrap your head around if you don't, if you decide not to do any further research. Mm-hmm. Like even if you, one of Hannity's recent conspiracies, that was, he was claiming that CNN had staged an anti-ISIS
Correct.
Muslim rally.
Right.
And he, of course, he's been reporting this false story that Seth Rich, who had supposedly released the DNC emails, was killed by the DNC, even though his own network, by the way, which had reported it, mm-hmm. also retracted the story.
Mm-hmm. And the family asked for this for him to stop.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that's the odd part too. And I saw this with James Tracy, who I had a very public spat with, because he was going after the parents of people who lost kids at Newtown. These people have kids and they have families, and the fact that they're actually willing to go after families who are grieving and suffering to hype up this just baseless claim, it says something about the individual. I think it speaks volumes about the individual that you're willing to go after grieving parents to falsify some narrative.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is also related to the general mistrust of intellectuals in this country. And that, to me, is also, again, related to the lack of public intellectuals. So we don't have this deep tradition. We don't have this sort of Jean-Paul Sartre tradition in our country. You do have the Cornel Wests and the Michael Eric Dysons, so forth and so on. But we need more, I think, in this country. Intellectuals have hidden themselves within the ivory tower, and there's not enough commentary in the sort of popular cultural sphere.
Yeah, I would agree. So we're going to talk about all these things and in conspiracy culture with Dr. Catherine Olmsted after this short musical break.
Tears to my eyes, cause it invokes the feelings of death, crime, pain, fear, genocide. Even my own government been behind many crimes, from killing JFK to 9/11. The Pentagon ain't nothing but a pentagram. Agents of Satan be disguised as some gentlemen. Listen, man, William Cooper tried to warn us, and I'm convinced they orchestrated the mayhem that occurred in New Orleans. And AIDS ain't nothing but a man-made virus aimed at my people that was born into bondage. Can tell me who to keep smuggling the drugs and the guns up in the country. I smell something funky, or should I say fishy? The cops wanna brush you when you hustle like Nipsey, but I'm still on the corner, man, in my system. Whether drunk or sober, still a rebel to the system, cause the powers that be try to lead us to extinction. R.I.P. Tats, help us never to forget them. And do you know, the government then came in contact with UFOs. Area 51, 2012, still moving close, but I don't think it's the end. And if it is, that just means it's something else that began. I'm saying, something ain't right, trust me, I know all about it. Don't nobody care, so they never talk about it. We all sleep, homie, I just had to call it out. We all sheep, steady headed to the slaughterhouse. Something ain't right, trust me, I know all about it. Don't nobody care, so they never talk about it. We all sleep, homie, I just had to call it out. We all sheep, steady headed to the slaughterhouse. Blind like my eyes wide shut, I cannot be. As high as I be, I could probably see the Anunnaki. Illuminati, take the music, used to move your body. Was never stupid, so a school is where you usually find me. For the love of money, we'd do a lot. Could we kill over something that does not exist? Pay attention, I'll show you how deep it goes. They got us all distracted by reality TV shows. Do not get it twisted, do not be fooled. Barack, but a damn tool for the same crooked system we all are oppressed by. Gentrificated all the way from Compton to Bed-Stuy. They rotted the economy, Bush made debts high. Now grandmom's working at McDonald's or Best Buy. Weather all jacked up, sky looking different. It's feeling like July in the middle of November. Billy Bang, how do you explain these things? Just go and Google H-A-A-R-P. Hip-hop was created as an ART, but somehow we got to use it to save our seeds. All my brothers that's in the prison industrial system, wishing that they could get their freedom, but the judges was unforgiving. I pray the Lord that all my people can hear me, because it's more than a conspiracy theory. Real. Something ain't right, trust me, I know all about it. Don't nobody care, so they never talk about it. We all sleep, homie, I just had to call it out. We all sheep, steady headed to the slaughterhouse. Something ain't right, trust me, I know all about it. Don't nobody care, so they never talk about it. We all sleep, homie, I just had to call it out. We all sheep, steady headed to the slaughterhouse.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and we are talking about conspiracy culture. We are excited to welcome Dr. Catherine Olmsted to the show. Dr. Olmsted is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Olmsted's research develops one of the central themes of the 20th century U.S., the influence of anti-communism on American politics and policy. Her first book, Challenging the Secret Government, examined conservatives' use of anti-communist rhetoric to undermine efforts to reform intelligence agencies in the 1970s. Her second book, Red Spy Queen, which is a personal favorite of mine, analyzed how the spy scare of the 1940s enabled anti-communists to move the nation's political discourse to the right. Her third book, Real Enemies, explored how conspiracy theories about the U.S. government, especially anti-communist theories, have been used to enlarge national security state. And her newest book is Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism, which explores the conservative reaction to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Dr. Olmsted, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And the reason we want to have you on, we were having this discussion about Donald Trump's presidency kind of being the first real victory of conspiracy culture, that he was able to tap into this conspiracy culture and launch a successful campaign. I think this really speaks to your book, Real Enemies, which I would think has only become more and more relevant as each year passes. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about sort of Donald Trump's campaign and its relation to conspiracy culture.
Well, Donald Trump began his political career as a conspiracy theorist. He started first getting into politics as a leader in the birther movement and saying that President Obama was not eligible to be president because he hadn't been born in the United States. And he kept beating this drum even after it was conclusively proven that Obama was born in the United States. And he really established, Trump really established his reputation by saying you can't trust the mainstream media, you can't trust government documents, you can't trust anything that the so-called experts say. So his election as president was really the logical culmination of his whole approach to politics and to American government. He's the culmination of this long-term trend of declining trust in government.
And so he has this, so, you know, Trump obviously tapped into something that already existed, although he was a part of this as well. So since your book Real Enemies came out discussing the history of conspiracies in the United States and their usage, would you say, you know, how have you seen it change since your conspiracy culture changed since your Real Enemies book was released?
I'm surprised and dismayed to say that it's only gotten worse. I thought that my book came out in 2009, and I thought that Obama's election and what I hoped would be a more transparent administration and a more transparent approach to governing would have restored faith in the government and somewhat dissipated the energy of all of these people who believed in conspiracy theories about the government. But in fact, as you know, the opposite happened, and the decline in the trust of government continued, and in addition, a decline in the trust in mainstream media accelerated as well.
Dr. Olmsted, this is Nick Baham. I'm wondering if you can give us a historical perspective here on conspiracy culture. In other words, how far back does this go in American political culture? You know, can we date this back to the American Revolution?
Oh, yeah, even further than that. I mean, the first time that, an English colonist set foot on the Virginia shore, there were conspiracy theories in America. There were conspiracy theories in the 17th and 18th centuries about slave revolts, about Indians, and especially about Catholics. A lot of the Protestant English colonists were worried, justifiably so, about the big Catholic empires that surrounded them, and they were worried that agents for the French or the Spanish were infiltrating their American experiment. And then with the Revolution, there are some scholars who say that the Declaration of Independence was the original American conspiracy theory, because it can be read as a litany of complaints about the English king. In fact, a litany of accusations of conspiracy against him. And then after the United States became a nation, there were conspiracy theories in the early Republic about the French Revolution and about how there were French revolutionaries coming over to the United States to infiltrate it. There were conspiracy theories about secret societies, about the Masons and the Illuminati. And then during the Civil War, there were conspiracy theories on both sides about the slave power conspiracy or about the supposed abolitionist conspiracy. So these things have a long history. But what I argue in my book is that there's a real turning point in the 20th century, right around World War I, when the U.S. government began to get a serious secret state, when there were when it expanded its powers of surveillance and it criminalized political dissent with the Espionage and Sedition Acts during World War I. That at that point, Americans began to have many conspiracy theories about their government because their government was much more powerful and much more secretive. And as the 20th century progresses, although you still have anti-Masonic conspiracy theories and conspiracy theories about various minority racial or religious groups, those theories become less powerful, less widespread, and instead you have many more conspiracy theories about the American government. That is the federal government, in fact, that is the chief enemy of American democracy.
Is there a relationship? You mentioned anti-Catholic conspiracy as well as Masonic, and I'm wondering if you see a relationship between anti-Catholic, anti-Masonic, and anti-Muslim conspiracy, especially in the Obama era. And I'm thinking about like the relationship you might see between people like Al Smith, JFK, and Obama in that area of specific religious conspiracy.
Well, that's a really interesting point, and I don't think it's necessarily about religion, it's more about being part of an international organization that is therefore inimical to American nationalism. So that was the fear about Catholicism. That was a lot of the fear directed at Al Smith in 1928 when he was the first Catholic nominee of a major party, that you're not actually loyal to the United States, you're loyal to the Catholic Church, to the Pope. This is the accusation leveled against Jews. You know, you're not really American, you're more part of an international Jewish organization, international Jewish conspiracy. That was the fears about the Masons, that they were loyal to the Masonic order and not to the United States. And so I think this is a large part of the fear directed against Muslims, that they're not really somehow American, they're not loyal to the United States, they're loyal to some sort of international religious ideal.
So this is sort of a speculative question as a follow-up to what you're saying here. But I get this question a lot from students. If Bernie Sanders had won the Democratic nomination 2016, would we have seen, in your view, this sort of Jewish conspiracy thing cropping up in this country?
Oh, I think definitely. And I mean, we're seeing a lot of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, even just with Trump's election,
correct?
Because
yes.
Of Jared Kushner.
Correct.
So following that, and again, this speaks to how much of the all of the stuff you've written continues to only become more and more relevant. But this Russian hacking conspiracy has dominated a lot of left-leaning media over the last few years. And I wonder how do you see this Russian hacking story fitting into your larger narrative about conspiracy culture in America?
Well, this is something that I'm just starting to look into. But it is interesting that with Trump's election, you get a rise in the left-wing conspiracy theories. And increasingly, on Twitter, at least, I don't think there have been any polls, so it's hard to know how widespread this is, but certainly if you look at Twitter, you see a lot of left-wing conspiracy theories about Russian control of the U.S. government.
So is that traditional throughout our history, that the opposition the opposition starts going down into conspiracy culture as a way to combat those in power?
Absolutely. So with George W. Bush's election, you saw a rise in left-wing conspiracy theories about the Bush administration, and those 9/11 theories become much less prominent once Bush is out of office, and instead the dominant conspiracy theory is about Obama not supposedly being American or not being Christian. And so now with Republicans in power, it's what scholars of conspiracy theories would predict, is that the people who lost the election or who are suspicious of the person who won, even if they weren't supportive of the opposing candidate, are now peddling their own conspiracy.
Dr. Olmsted, this is sort of a broader philosophical question to a degree, but I guess what I want to know is, how do conspiracy theories and theorists sort of inhibit us from dealing with actual conspiracies, in the sense that, so, you know, Nolan brought up left-wing conspiracies about Russian control. But let's say, for example, and again, you know, I'm sort of using a conspiracy theory here too, but let's say, for example, that the intention of Russian interference in our election was simply not so much to put Trump into power, but to destabilize American democracy, right? To cause issues, dissent, questions around how we elect our president. How do left-wing conspiracies about Russian interference actually prohibit us from dealing with what's really happening?
Well, I think you've put it very well there. Thomas Pynchon once said something like, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. And I think this is true again and again in the conspiracy theory history in America, is that there have been real conspiracies by the government, but a lot of times the people who start asking questions ask the wrong questions, and as a result, they get diverted and focus on very minor issues and lose sight of the big picture. So, for example, with the Iraq War, unquestionable that President Bush misled the country about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think that there were a lot of interesting questions that the Senate Intelligence Committee was investigating about Saudi intelligence and Pakistani intelligence relationship with the 9/11 hijackers that were never fully explored. So I think that there are unanswered questions about 9/11. I think that the Bush administration lied about the Iraq War. I think those are all things that we should be asking about and investigating as American citizens. But instead, a lot of the conspiracy theories are focused on, you know, the actual physical destruction of the Twin Towers or Building 7. And so they get distracted on down and go down these alleys that, in my opinion, are not going to be useful or helpful in terms of uncovering what Americans really need to know.
Okay, we are talking to Dr. Catherine Olmsted, a professor of history at University of California, Davis, about conspiracy culture and media. And we're going to take a short musical break. When we return, I want to talk to Dr. Olmsted about how this affects education and how she reacts to conspiracy culture as an educator. We'll be back on the Project Censored Show after this short musical break.
For Vietnam, where I got my legs shot off. I recall a quote from a movie that said, who's more man than a man with a reason that's worth dying for? They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. At the back of the line when it comes to getting ahead. They gave me a uniform and a tiny salted pill. Stopped the big urge I might have for the wrong kind of thrill. They put a gun in my hand and said, shoot till he's dead. But it's hard to kill when please I'm your friend echoes through your head. Brought up in church, taught no man to take another's life. But then put in the jungle when life has no price. No. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. And I stand at the back of the line when it comes to getting ahead. The world of paper reads today. Another war is in the brewing. But what about the lives of yesterday and the many happy families that have been
is a hooker and my nephew's a junkie too. But they say I have no right to tell them how they should do. They laugh and say quit bragging about the war you should have never been in. But my mind is so brainwashed I'd probably go back and do it again. I walk the neighborhood parade in my purple heart with a fear of Agent O, Inspector One World Star. No, they had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. And I stand in the back of the line when it comes to getting the hill. Yeah. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. Now I stand at the back of the line when it comes to getting ahead. Would you believe I do? They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. They had me standing on the front line. But now I stand at the back of the line when it comes to getting ahead.
Welcome back to the Project Centered Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and we have the honor of speaking to Dr. Catherine Olmsted, a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. And we're talking about conspiracy culture in media. And Dr. Olmsted, I kind of want to ask a general question that I always find just fascinating to ask individuals when they publish or release anything, which is, how did you find yourself studying conspiracies in the first place?
It grew out of my earliest work. My first book was published in 1996 by the University of North Carolina Press. It's called Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI. And it was about the journalistic and congressional investigations of the intelligence community after Watergate. So a lot of it has to do with the Church Committee, as well as other congressional committees, and Seymour Hersh and Daniel Shore, and a lot of the journalists who were very aggressive in covering the CIA and FBI after Watergate. So this book was my dissertation. It was published by an academic press, so it isn't the sort of thing where you would expect to get a lot of public attention. But I found that I started getting letters. This is the late 90s, so people weren't using email so much. I started getting letters in my mailbox at UC Davis that were filled with newspaper clippings, where people would cut things, the stories out of the newspaper, and they'd highlight them with yellow highlighter, and then they'd write me these long letters about how they were glad that I was helping to uncover government conspiracies by writing this book, and I should know about these other conspiracies. And then I started getting phone calls in my office here at UC Davis from people who said that they were being followed by the FBI, or the CIA had implanted surveillance equipment in their molars, and they needed the name of a good dentist so it could be removed. And
Those people contact you too? That's good.
Yeah. So, but what I found interesting is that a lot of the times I would be having conversations with these people, and they would be very knowledgeable about the Church Committee and about various CIA programs in the past, and they would say, you know, I was in a bar in Baltimore in 1956, and I'm sure that I was part of this MKUltra program where the CIA was dropping LSD in my drink, and ever since then I've had these, you know, voices talking in my head. And it was clear that they needed a medication adjustment, but what I was interested in is how they were able to really document the story of their life and their feeling of being under surveillance with real government programs and evidence of real government conspiracies. And I became really fascinated by, how do you draw the line between what's considered crazy in our culture and what is a reasonable suspicion or question that you have about your government? Because there have been these documented abuses of power by the U.S. government. There's been evidence of what we would consider crazy programs by the CIA, like MKUltra, or like the various plots against Fidel Castro with the exploding seashell and the, you know, poison scuba suit and all that sort of thing. So how do you tell what's crazy and what's, you know, a good question that an engaged citizen should ask? And so I went to look at Frank Church's papers in Boise, Idaho, and looked at all the mail that he got, and he got thousands of letters. This was a senator who led the investigation into the CIA and FBI after Watergate, and he had experienced the same thing, only on a much bigger scale than I had, of all of these people contacting him and saying, I know the government is watching me. I know I'm the victim of a government conspiracy. Can you help me? And so I became interested in the relationship between real government conspiracies and conspiracy theories about the government.
Okay, so kind of as a follow-up question to that, you know, your book Real Enemies, I recall the sort of, when the time when it came out, there was a lot of conspiracies. It really inflamed by the internet, and then the government was doing many things that people disapproved of, and that also fed some of this conspiracy culture. And, you know, I've generally found that even when you try and go in sort of rationally to discuss with people conspiracies, whether they are true or not, if you start challenging the evidence, you usually get quite a negative backlash. And I'm wondering if you could kind of speak a little bit about what was the reaction you received when you released Real Enemies? You know, were you receiving sort of threats or massive complaints in like your email, et cetera, from releasing this book?
You mean from conspiracy theorists?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, certainly I ran into that a lot. I suppose most notably in 2011, the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, there was an event that the 9/11 Memorial in New York held about conspiracy theories about 9/11. And it now seems in retrospect kind of crazy that they would do this. But I think the people who were organizing the memorial, this was in May and it was going to open in September, were trying to have these series of monthly events to get people excited about, aware of the opening of the memorial. And they wanted to actually reach out to the conspiracy community and say, this is your memorial too. And so I was on a panel with another scholar of conspiracy theories, a very esteemed professor from Syracuse, Michael Barkun, and we were talking about why very rational Americans would believe in conspiracy theories about 9/11, about how the Bush administration flies would contribute to this. And so we felt like we were, trying to be open and receptive and engage in a dialogue with the 9/11 truth community, but they felt otherwise, got very angry, and they ended up closing the event before it was supposed to be done, deciding to get the cutoff question. So I have really confronted angry conspiracists. On the other hand, I would say that there are a lot of people who are willing to have a dialogue and who are willing to engage in critical discussion of the evidence. So it isn't really a black and white affair, but there certainly are a lot of people who believe in conspiracy theory who are closed-minded as people in the government who don't want to believe there are ever conspiracies. And so it's a challenge as an educator and a scholar to get people to sort of question their assumptions and consider other possibilities.
I'm glad you kind of brought that up. That's something we've talked about a lot on the show in what we now call this post-truth America, which is how, when there's these individuals out there who really disregard facts or live in a world of what they're now calling alternative facts, it really kind of questions the almost educator academic model, right? Because it undermines this idea that we all agree on the facts, we may disagree on what they mean. So how have you dealt with that in the classroom? Have you seen a rise in that as this conspiracy culture has grown, maybe more and more resistance to factual-based analysis in your classroom?
You know, I have not. I have to say I've been very impressed with UC Davis students. Maybe it's because they're young and they're not, haven't been really set in their ways yet, but I have not encountered any students who at least are openly belligerent or unwilling to reconsider past biases. So I've been really pleased by that. In general, however, though, looking out over the culture as a whole, I'm dismayed by people's unwillingness to admit that there are things that are that are facts that you can't disagree about. You know, that when, for example, we know that Barack Obama was born in Hawaii in August of 1961, you know, as well as we know any historical fact at all, you know, considering the birth announcements in both papers, the birth certificates, the eyewitness accounts, everything. And yet there are still people who say, oh, all of that is fake. Well, if all of that is fake, then we really don't know anything in history, because, you know, this is how historians view the world, is that you can find documents in the past, and there are ways that you determine if they're true or not, and then you base your interpretation on these facts. And if we can't agree on what the facts are, then it's hard to have a conversation.
So where do we go from here? You know, how do we combat this going forward? Because the picture that you're painting is one in which we get increasingly more and more polarized, and we all move to our separate conspiracy spaces, right? And in so doing, there becomes less and less that we share in the public sphere, specifically fewer and fewer facts that we're willing to agree upon when we meet in the public sphere.
Right. Well, I don't know. Now you're really depressing me. I'm not sure exactly how we can solve this. I mean, I've just been saying for the last, you know, 15 years that I've been teaching conspiracy theories, I've been urging my students to really make the effort to search out what is true and not just accept the news they find on the internet that confirms their preconception. I mean, it's hard work being a citizen in a democracy, but we have to be willing to put in that hard work in order for the system to work.
What do you think right now is the most dangerous conspiracy theory that we're dealing with in the United States?
The most dangerous one. I would suppose the truly dangerous ones would be ones that the president believes, because he's the one with all the power, right?
Right, that's correct.
So that's what I'd be really concerned about, is, you know, what is gonna trigger his conspiracy mindset. As far as the ones that are out among the public, there's lots of them that are very concerning. Obviously, the anti-Muslim conspiracy theories, if they lead to attacks on people, you know, like what happened in Portland, then we're really headed for a very dark place. So I'm encouraged by how much Americans seem willing to fight back against that conspiracy mindset, though.
So
maybe it's just a product of living in California and in Davis, but it seems to me like a lot of people are fighting back, in particular against the anti-minority group conspiracy.
I know we have a couple more minutes with you, and I just wanted to ask, before you came on the show, we were discussing this idea about public academics and the responsibility of maybe academics to try and reach out to the public. And I'm wondering what your feelings are on that. Do you think that may compromise the concept of the academy, or do you think we should encourage academics to reach out to the public more? And do you even think that would perhaps solve the potential problems with conspiracy culture?
Well, I don't think it'll solve it, but I think we have to try. So, yes, absolutely, I believe that academics have to reach out. It's very comfortable to enjoy the ivory tower and, you know, teach to smart, like-minded students, but we have to try and reach out. This summer, I'm going to update my book, Real Enemies, and add another chapter that takes us up to the present. So, in a way, I don't really want to do that. I'm going to be dwelling in, you know, a very sad place for a while and reading a lot of things that I would rather not know existed. But on the other hand, I think it's essential to place the 2016 election and what's happened since in historical context, and to try and, as an academic, make my work relevant to the present.
Okay. We've been talking to Dr. Catherine Olmsted, professor of history at University of California, Davis. Dr. Olmsted, it's wonderful to have you on the show. We really appreciate it. And I want to remind our listeners that she's got two books in particular I'm going to recommend: Right Out of California, the 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism, and also the one that's dominated most of our conversation today, Real Enemies. So check out Real Enemies. It's a great book. Check out anything Olmsted does. She does amazing work. So thank you very much for coming on the Project Censored show.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
All right. We'll be back after this short musical break.
So how you feeling down there? It's a cold, cruel, harsh reality. Caught, stuck here with your enemies. Who do you think you are?
just couldn't stop. You turned the ones that you love into the angriest mob. And the one last wish is that you pay for it. And there's no way you're getting out of this. Who do you think you are? It's 20 to 1, yeah, so you better run. You got the world on its knees, you're taking all that you please. You want more, yeah. But still you're nothing for me. You like the burden we bear, you love the hate that we share. You want more, yeah. But still you're nothing for me. But enemies, enemies, enemies.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with Dr. Nicholas Bayham III and our special announcer, Amy Casey. I love talking to Dr. Olmsted. Really just a great academic, great person, and always willing to chat with us. But I want to kind of shift gears. You know, it's funny, a couple weeks ago, Nick had said something on the air. Remember we said, name a couple people in corporate media whose shows you like, and then Lawrence O'Donnell was one of the ones you listed, and I think it was days later, Lawrence O'Donnell got fired.
Yeah, although the news was that he was supposed to be fired, and they have actually renewed his contract.
Oh.
Yeah, so he will be back for, my understanding is that he will be back for another 2 years.
Well, I kind of thought you were like the angel of death, so I'd say maybe you could say nice things about Hannity and others, and then maybe they get fired.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work that way. I think I'm the angel of hope. At least I'm hoping.
So I thought, yeah, this the attempt to fire O'Donnell weeks, actually months earlier, had been reported that new management had come in at MSNBC, and they were trying to tap more into conservative viewers and put a more conservative agenda. And so they hired people like George Will and Megyn Kelly, Gretchen Carlson, and these other people, right? So they hired this more conservative group, people like radio host Hugh Hewitt and former RNC chairman Michael Steele. And so we're starting to see this shift toward conservative media. And I see it as this larger war on journalism, because it's funny, you look at like the every poll about the youth generation, and talking about millennials here, they are like, one Republican pollster called them frighteningly liberal, that they believe in these social liberal ideals, these big government spending, everything that the sort of conservatives disagree with. So you would figure that the media would reflect that, because they want to tap into that and make dollars off these liberal viewers having their views reinforced, just like they had done for conservatives since the 1970s. But awkwardly, the media is shifting more conservative, and I see it as a war on journalism. I think it's tied to what we talked about with Dr. Olmsted, that a lot of this conservative media taps into these conspiracy theories. And as a result, they're seen as working against the mainstream, and that attracts viewers. And I think this is also furthered by Trump had launched this war on journalism, and the senator candidate in Montana who slammed a journalist actually got elected. And I just thought, like, is that a Republican or Democrat idea that we shouldn't slam journalists? Like, is that partisan, or don't we all kind of agree that you shouldn't be slamming anyone, but especially the fourth estate that's there to monitor you? That serves all of us, this idea.
Yeah.
So I wonder what your thoughts were watching this transition take place and kind of the discourses on media.
Well, for me, this is all about entertainment and dollars. So the hiring specifically at MSNBC of conservative hosts is, I think, about putting people on the air within the Republican Party who have specific beefs with Trump. So everybody that you've mentioned there, with I think the exception of Greta Van Susteren, have specific complaints about Trump. Megyn Kelly maybe being the big win one there, okay? But Hugh Hewitt as well has not minced words about Trump. And if we look at other people that MSNBC has catered to for quite some time, Joe Scarborough, I think Joe has really opened this up. This is one of the more popular programs on MSNBC. I took the liberty of watching it this morning before I came in for us to record the program. And both he and Mika are now going on these constant rants about Trump's sanity. As if I'm going to be an objective observer of this, it's purely entertainment. So you're not actually giving me information. I think that Trump is insane as well. That's great. But how politically relevant is that? Does that move the chain forward to getting past Trump and past American authoritarianism? Or is it simply entertaining in the way that, you know, a meme that you see of Trump might be on Facebook or something like that, or Kathy Griffin posing with Trump's bloody severed head. It's just entertainment.
Doug, I'm glad you brought up Kathy Griffin, because Kathy Griffin loses her job at CNN for taking this picture of holding up a bloody head. I don't know if it's art, political statement, neither, both, whatever. But anyway, so she loses her job. But Jeffrey Lord keeps his job, and he's blaming Ariana Grande for the attack at her concert, as if that's somehow she asked for these people to die.
Right.
You know, he's also been the one who said the KKK was a progressive organization, and Lord's able to keep his job. Brian Williams is able to keep his job when he's supposedly in a helicopter that gets hit by a missile that never happened, right?
Correct.
But you have these other individuals in media who are doing journalism or actually critiquing those in power losing their job. But I think the other important point about your statement as well about being entertainment, like we saw this during the Comey hearings. The Comey hearings kind of turned into entertainment. I don't think Comey necessarily mentioned anything that hadn't been told before. It really confirmed it. And what scared me about it was not necessarily the attention to Comey, was at the very same time, Congress was passing legislation to gut the Consumer Protection Bureau. It was trying to rush through Trump's healthcare plan while the media dominated the story of Comey. And I think we have seen this failure a lot in our history, but I think it's ramped up in the Trump era, where we get addicted to this story that you could argue is really important. The president obstructing justice is a hugely important story, but it's not going to be solved at that hearing, and it's not going to be solved in that day. And there's many other things that actually are happening day.
Like the deregulation of banks, which was happening while we were all paying attention to Comey. And Comey is entertainment in the sense that it's not simply important what he says, but how he says it. And that's what we pay attention to. Is he credible, for example? This is all bread and circuses. You're in the new Rome. So, you know, you're Jeffrey Lord. I mean, you're one step away from Jeffrey Lord being in the arena with a shield and a sword, you know, battling it out. I feel really quite badly for people who are real journalists and who are actually doing substantive work, of which I think that Lawrence O'Donnell has done some substantive work. But again, he is also an entertainment figure too, okay? Trump is an entertainment figure. We've taken reality television and entertainment and put it center in the public political sphere. It's all a distraction. While banks are being deregulated, so forth and so on, and other regulations are dropped that now you don't have consumer protection over things. You're losing the protections that students have had with respect to student loans. You've got Betsy DeVos writing a ridiculous education budget that's going to hurt millions of Americans while the entertainment goes on. I could even add that even though I think the Washington Post has done some great reporting on the quote-unquote Russian conspiracy, scandal or conspiracy, depending upon how you choose to look at it, we have to understand that Jeff Bezos is owns the Washington Post. So what you in effect have is two business people, Bezos and Trump, who despise one another. And we're watching them through our media have this sort of public clash of two very wealthy people. This does not serve the people of this country to merely sit back and watch the entertainment that now passes for news, or to watch, in effect, two rich people battle it out over what is a fact and what is not a fact. It's a distraction to us all. Neither, in truth, neither Bezos nor Trump are people that we want in control of our politics. The question is, will there be any truth ever that comes out of this spectacle that we're watching, this entertainment spectacle? It has all become that film Network. As you remember, that it wasn't just Howard Beale. There were a host of other programs that were put on, you know, Revolutionary, People's Hour, or whatever it was called, which in a sense made Black Power an entertainment piece, right? It's all entertainment. We're not dealing with anything substantive. And everything has been bastardized in our media right now.
Yeah, I think that entertainment component is key because, I mean, there's like this, it gives people this like false sense of power, right? Like right. So-and-so stuck it to Trump or Trump stuck it to so-and-so.
Right.
But while these things are going on, you have the gutting of this legislation. It's like you have people's education being cut. That's going to affect people's lives. You have students who are going to be in debt for 30, 40 years because of these decisions. People are going to die without healthcare. People are going to lose their home because of this deregulation. Those are the real stories. I mean, and no matter how empowered you feel about Trump's election or removed from office or whatever, that's not going to matter when you're homeless or starving or dead.
Correct.
And so I think that that's a real critical piece to emphasize. So I think that this shift in media is something to pay attention to as the public ironically shifts further toward liberal ideas. The media that's informing them is shifting more conservative, further undermining that false narrative out of the Reagan administration about the supposed liberal media.
That's correct.
So speaking of media, we got to get to our content from the world of the Media Freedom Foundation. So everyone knows here at the Media Freedom Foundation, we produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world, and we offer alternative narratives to the corporate press. So Amy Casey, our special announcer, is here to tell us more.
All right. Thank you, Nolan, and greetings, listeners. I am Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are working on. From Saybrook University in Oakland, California, Dr. Mark Pilisic published War, Missing from Public Response to Trump, but Urgent at projectcensored.org. The article discusses the lack of protest and resistance towards military spending and action despite the uptick in issue-based resistant movements since President Trump's inauguration. This article can be found at projectcensored.org. From Diablo Valley College, Project Censored director Mickey Huff and his student Elsa Dennis have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled The Pentagon Money Pit, $6.5 trillion in unaccountable army spending and no DOD audit. The story describes the decades-long mystery of missing taxpayer money allocated to the Pentagon for which Congress has not held the department accountable. That can also be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his students Teresa Lemus and Alexandra Valencia have published The Politics of Ultrasound Scans. The story looks at the newly introduced Heartbeat Protection Act and how politicians have politicized ultrasound technology in an attempt to create a new definition of a living human being. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams and his student Sarah Henderson from the University of Vermont have released Music in a Digital Age. The article notes that the music industry has always been adapting to changes in technology, but the advent of the social media age can only be described as a disruptive revolution. Also at gcml.org, Blue Light Blockers, The Ultimate Truth. This article, written by Dr. Rob Williams and his student Abigail Judith Stone at the University of Vermont, warns that as you spend hours viewing light-emitting screens in your dark bedroom, the blue light wavelengths quickly become your silent sleep killer by offsetting your circadian rhythm. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/show. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you, Amy. Amy, weren't you saying, did you say you went and saw the new Wonder Woman film?
No, I haven't yet, but I have heard some reviews and some interesting talking points about its release.
Are you getting excited?
Oh, definitely.
What's the discussion like about Wonder Woman? I haven't even really heard much.
Well, I've heard good things. It's gotten great reviews, and it did have the biggest opening weekend for a female director, so that was wonderful. But my favorite talking point was a Fox News panel discussing Wonder Woman's Americanness, and that they were criticizing the film, not not for the content of the actual movie or the stars or the message, but just the fact that she wasn't wearing the red, white, and blue and our flag and overall was less American than what they were anticipating.
And what is with these people's addiction to like these American colors? Like, I could cry over something. The flag and material, it's really weird how they talk to material. I don't understand, but...
Well, and they were talking about catering to the international community, that a lot of films in the past have had to pull back the American patriotic model to satisfy the international community, because let's face it, the world is not about America.
She is actually French-based in the film. She works out of an office at the Louvre in Paris. So you can imagine that it's problematic to a certain segment of the political right.
Oh, I wish Bill O'Reilly was still in the air. His head would explode. Right. French Wonder Woman? Oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, we look forward to hearing more about that. So we want to hear some more from you when you get in that. So thank you for everything. And I want to thank Dr. Catherine Olmsted. It was a pleasure to have her on the show. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and our intern and special announcer, Amy Casey. Desiree McSwain, our other co-host, will return soon. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are executive producers and hosts. Mitch Scorza is our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcenseredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all of our shows for the past 6 years, as well as other content and 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us.
And that brings to a close the Project Censored Radio.
Control others is an enormous addictive.
We're going to move on. It's 9:59, time for Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. And following that, we got the food show for people who love to eat, and like that. And jazz follows at noon, of course. Let's listen to one message before we go on to Air Cascadia.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1930.
You know what? We're getting some interference. Let me just play some music here. Thank you.